I want to be alive. I am alive. Alive, I tell you. Mother, I love you. I want to hold you. I want to run in the stream. I want to be alive. I am alive. Alive, I tell you. Mother, bypassing override. Hold you. I want to run in the stream. I am alive.
Post-apocalyptic scavenger. Hello and welcome to the podcast that will be lost in time like tears in the rain. Film Bookcast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. My name is Mike Smith. Joining me as always is a man who may or may not be a replicant.
Mike DiCrescia.
How are you doing today, Mike?
I'm doing well. I'm a little existentially nervous right now since you just posed that question. But otherwise, fine.
Yeah, you will wonder about this for the next 35 years or so.
Yes. And then a sequel will come out and then my answers will be had.
Or they won't answer the question at all.
Or that too. That's possible also.
If you've never listened to Film Bookcast before, first we start with some film news and then we move on into some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever piece of media we've been consuming lately. And then after that, we move on into our feature review. This week, we are discussing the new film from director Denis Villeneuve and the sequel to Ridley Scott's Blade Runner. It's called Blade Runner 2049. And I'm excited to talk about this one, Mike, because we should have talked about this weeks ago.
But there was no problems that anyone had in specific that caused it to be this late.
Yep, it was just pure laziness on our part is exactly what it was. No, I mean, our last episode of this podcast was our New York Comic Con episode, and that one came out a week late because we were both super sick. But this movie came out during New York Comic Con, like that weekend, and so we couldn't see it that weekend. And then the plan was to do the Blade Runner episode the next week, but then we were both sick, so we had to delay our Comic-Con episode. And then by the time we were both able to see Blade Runner 2049, it had been out for almost a month. So,
yeah.
But we still really wanted to talk about it for the podcast, and there's not that many other big movies out right now, so we might as well just keep talking about Blade Runner, Mike.
Yeah, let's talk about it forever.
Yeah, but we will do that later on. Right now, we got to get into some film news.
Hi! It's time for...
What?
It's time for...
It's time for some film news here on Film Bookcast. And Mike, because we haven't done a proper episode of Film Bookcast in about a month or so, we had like a month's worth of news to get through. And there are a lot of different stories going around that I wanted to discuss. And if we had time, we would go into them. But, you know, we don't. So I kind of picked out the ones that were most appealing to me. And obviously, we're going to start with some superhero movie news. I got a few things here going on that I got to discuss. First of which... is that Gore Verbinski, one of my favorite working directors, as you well know. I've talked about this in the podcast several times. He is now directing Gambit for Fox.
That is going to be the weirdest movie of all time.
This is another movie that should probably not be being made.
yeah, correct.
You know, I mean, it's one of those things. The only reason Gambit is being made is because Channing Tatum wanted to make a Gambit movie. And this was years ago. Like, he worked something out with Fox, and he wanted to play Gambit. So Fox was like, you're Channing Tatum, you're a big star. Sure, we'll give you a Gambit movie. Why not?
Yeah.
And this movie has cycled through, like, a couple of different directors. I know Rupert Wyatt was supposed to make it at one point, the guy who directed Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Doug Liman, I think, was attached to this at one point, if I'm not mistaken, the guy who did Edge of Tomorrow. And so there's a lot of talent has passed through the gates of Gambit and has left...
Yep.
Just as quickly. So now Gore Verbinski is attached to direct Gambit for Fox. This is one of those things in the same situation where like Ryan Reynolds kept Deadpool alive for 7 years after X-Men Origins came out and finally came out with that movie and it worked. Channing Tatum's kind of been doing the same thing, even though he hasn't actually had the chance to play Gambit yet. So I'm eager to see this if Gore Verbinski ends up actually making this movie. Again,
is Channing Tatum still attached? Because at one point, didn't it become Taylor Kitsch for a while? And then now it's
Taylor Kitsch was Gambit. He was Gambit in X-Men Origins Wolverine.
Why would you think I know that? Well, because I know who you are, Gambit. You're the guy who escaped, and you're the guy who's going to take me back there.
Those are mighty nice tags you have on there, sir. The man who took me wore tags just like them.
Now, Bub, you listen to me.
Oh, that was it. Okay. Yeah,
so Taylor Kitsch was the original Gambit on film, and I guess Fox did not want to do the same thing they did with Taylor Kitsch, or the same thing they did with Ryan Reynolds as with Taylor Kitsch. Yeah, Channing Tatum, a few years after Wolverine came out, was said, like, hey, I would like to do Gambit, and Fox told him, like, yeah, we would like to do Gambit with you, and it has never coalesced yet, but it seems like it might now, and Fox is a pretty packed slate as it is right now. I mean, in 2018, they've got Deadpool 2, they've got the new X-Men movie, X-Men Dark Phoenix, and they've got New Mutants, which I don't know if you've seen the trailer for New Mutants, Mike, but that came out pretty recently.
No.
And it's being marketed as a horror movie. And it looks,
what?
And it looks pretty good. I'm kind of into what it's doing, so...
Interesting.
Yeah, so I don't know where Gambit fits into that whole scheme of things, but Fox has never been super worried about continuity anyway, so...
No.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. But Gore Verbinski being attached to direct Gambit is very exciting to me. Also, another very exciting director being attached to a big superhero property, Gareth Evans, the director of The Raid and The Raid 2, is going to be is now attached to direct Deathstroke for DC, starring Joe Manganiello as Deathstroke. So, for those who don't know, Joe Manganiello was cast as Deathstroke to be the villain in Ben Affleck's Batman movie when Ben Affleck was directing it. But Ben Affleck's no longer directing it, and I don't think Joe Manganiello is in that movie anymore. But they cast him as Deathstroke, and I think he DC was like, well, we got to give him something. We got to give him
yeah, let's make him a movie, I guess.
So now Gareth Evans, the director of The Raid, is attached to direct Deathstroke, and that is fucking awesome. That is a cool thing right there. I don't know if Deathstroke will actually happen, because, again, DC has like 25 different movies in the works right now.
Yeah, but... and none of them are making or getting made ever.
I mean, we hope, like, definitely Justice League. That's coming out in a couple weeks.
So we'll give him that one.
I believe Justice League truly exists. I am confident Aquaman will come out since it's already filming. Mm-hmm. It's probably finished filming by now. And I'm pretty confident Wonder Woman 2 will happen. And I'm actually pretty confident that this next one will happen, Mike, if we're going to move off the Deathstroke news. Zachary Levi was just cast as Shazam. You don't seem as confident as I do, but...
well, that's just my general lack of DC knowledge and stuff. Like, I'm aware of the character Shazam. I just don't know how big of a character he is.
Well, the only reason the Shazam movie is being made is because the villain, Black Adam, is being played by The Rock.
Right.
And The Rock has been cast as Black Adam for years now. I think it was like 2014, like he was cast.
It's been a while, at least.
It's been a long time. And so Shazam is happening solely because The Rock is playing the villain, which to me seems like a mistake. He should be playing Shazam.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you're going to cast The Rock, why not have him as like your bright hero instead of this like dark villain? Because The Rock is all about his charisma.
And doesn't Black Adam also not talk? Right? Isn't that a thing?
You're thinking of Black Bolt from The Inhumans.
That was it. Okay, got it.
Which is airing on ABC right now, and it's supposed to be terrible. But it seems like Shazam is actually pretty close to happening. I think they're eyeing a shooting date in 2018. David F. Sandberg is attached to direct that movie. He's the guy who did Lights Out. He also did Annabelle Creation, which just came out last month, I think. Okay. And Zachary Levi, man, I mean, this is the dude who played Chuck on NBC for five seasons. You know, I think he was in Tangled, the Disney movie. And he's actually in Thor 2 and 3 as one of the Warriors 3, one of Thor's pals.
Right.
He replaced the actor who played that character in the first movie and played it in the second and third one. So, I mean, like, I really don't know this guy that much outside of his role with Thor 2. I haven't seen Thor 3 yet because it hasn't come out. But, yeah, I mean, that's cool. Good for him.
Yeah, I know. I think that's an interesting choice. Just if you look at Zachary Levi or picture him in your brain and then picture him next to The Rock, not really the same. You know, it doesn't seem like a fair fight, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
I mean, I'm sure he'll have to bulk up or whatever for the role when it comes down to it. My thing, though, and this probably was never going to happen, but there was a rumor going around a little while ago that Shazam was being cast and that DC was eyeing John Cena to play the role of Shazam.
Oh my god.
And how amazing would it be if DC spent $200 million on a big budget movie featuring John Cena against The Rock? It would be fucking WrestleMania, man, but on the big screen.
That would have been amazing.
It's superpowers. It would have been incredible. But that does not appear to be the case, which is a bummer for sure. But supposedly, I mean, Black Adam's supposed to get his own movie after the Shazam movie. Because, I mean, you got The Rock, you got to use him as much as you can. So if that Black Adam movie comes to pass, maybe they can cast John Cena in that one.
There you go.
In some capacity.
I like your optimism for John Cena.
I just really want him to have a good career.
Yeah, you know, it's just needs, he just needs a break.
He's a good dude. He's a good dude. You can't see him, you know, so you need he needs as much help as he can get.
Exactly.
Anyway, that, I think, wraps up our superhero movie news. Gore Verbinski, Gareth Evans, Zachary Levi are the big gets this past month. Also wanted to mention that Creed 2 is in the works. We talked about that a little bit. We're both big fans of the movie Creed. Yeah. And it looks like Sylvester Stallone will be writing and directing Creed 2. And this is a little bit of a change because Ryan Coogler was the writer and director of Creed 1. And some people were kind of upset about this, that Sloan was writing and directing. And I get it, you know, because Ryan Coogler brought so much to Creed. Like, Ryan Coogler is, I think, one of the most talented young directors working today. I think Black Panther is going to kick ass. You know, the trailers for that have been nothing short of insane. But I also, like, I wasn't really holding it. Like, I was hoping he would direct Creed 2. But I didn't really expect him to, because, I mean, he's working on Black Panther. In all likelihood, he'll probably end up doing Black Panther 2.
Right.
Just, you know, theoretically speaking. And Sylvester Stallone is the guy I would trust with Rocky after Ryan Coogler. Sylvester Stallone has directed 4 Rocky movies. It's not like it's it's not like this is unfamiliar territory for him.
Right.
And that, you know, covers the range. I mean, he directed 2, 3, 4, and 6. And that covers the range of, like, the goofy Rocky movies and the serious ones. And I feel like Creed 2, I want it to be, you know, a pretty serious movie. But at the same time, you know, it could be a little goofy, whatever.
Yeah.
So I'm totally fine with Sylvester Stallone directing Creed 2. I think that's probably, like, if it's not going to be Coogler, Stallone is the guy I would want to do it.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I definitely think that my favorite parts of Creed, or my favorite aspect of Creed, was Coogler's touch. Just, I remember the single take fight sequences that, you know, that all that choreography and everything, and just his style was my favorite part of Creed. But yeah, I agree. If we're going to go with a safe bet replacement, sure, Stallone, go ahead. Yeah, why not?
Why not? It's the
and it will probably be cool.
Yeah, it's the J.J. Abrams returning to Star Wars.
Right, exactly.
With Sylvester Stallone as for Creed 2. Actually, speaking of big director returns, Mike, I do have a couple of Fast and Furious related news.
Oh, of course you're going to get those in here.
That we got to get into. There's been a few things going on. So first of all, you may recall when we reviewed Fate of the Furious, I told you about this big behind-the-scenes feud of that movie between The Rock and Vin Diesel. You had no idea about it.
Right.
Until I mentioned it to you. Well, the big Fast and Furious feud continues because I think what's going on. So Fast and Furious 9 was supposed to come out in 2019. It's now been delayed to 2020. So a full year later. And the reason for it is that it's making room for a movie in 2019. The Rock and Jason Statham spinoff, baby.
God, didn't we talk about this when we reviewed Fate of the Furious also?
Yeah, that was talked about as like a possibility, like they wanted to do that, but it seems like that's definitely happening now. Apparently what's going down is that, you know, The Rock and Jason Statham are making their own spinoff movie, and some of the other cast members, particularly Tyrese Gibson, is not happy about it.
Oh, God.
He's been calling out The Rock on Twitter. It's been pretty funny to watch, because it's like, you're Tyrese Gibson, man. Just be glad that you're in the Furious movies and
just cash those checks and move on.
Yeah, so the Fast and Furious feud does continue, but I think it's going to pay off well for everyone involved because, A, The Rock and Jason Statham spinoff is what the world needs at the moment.
It can bring us all together.
Yeah, supposedly this won't happen, but the studio wants Shane Black to direct it, which would be insane. I say this won't happen because I really don't think it will, but...
But just imagine that buddy cop duo, or that buddy cop dynamic of Shane Black with Jason Statham and The Rock.
It would be incredible. I know right now Shane Black is probably in post-production on The Predator, which comes out in, I think, February. And then after that, I think his schedule is pretty much free. He had a couple other projects in the works, but nothing is concrete, set in stone yet. So if he fast-tracked it, he could do Fast 9.
It's possible.
Or this Fast and Furious spinoff if he wanted to. I don't think he'll want to, but he could. You never...
Yeah.
You never know.
It's possible.
But the other big Fast and Furious news, which just came out a couple of days ago, Vin Diesel announced via an Instagram post the director of Fast and Furious 9, and it is somebody who has shepherded the Fast and Furious franchise to what it is today.
Guess who the director is? You're not going to believe this. Think forefathers of Fast. Think the architects of the Fast saga, the Fast mythology. The one responsible for resurrecting this beautiful saga. Anybody know who it is?
Justin Lin! And the crowd goes wild! The Staples Center can't believe it! It's the three-point shot that made 9 and 10 incredible!
Justin Lin is coming back to direct Fast and Furious 9. Now, he left the franchise after 6. He directed 3, 4, 5, and 6, and then made his exit from the series. He went on to direct Star Trek Beyond. He worked on True Detective a little bit. He's been all over the place a little bit. He got attached to a bunch of different things. I remember he got attached to he was supposed to direct Space Jam 2.
That's right. Yeah. Holy shit. Yeah. I forgot about that.
Nothing's ever come. Nothing's come of that yet.
it's a ways off. Sure.
But yeah, I mean, Justin Lin coming back to Fast and Furious is pretty good news. I mean, he brought the franchise to what it is today. Fast 5 and 6 are kind of like, you know, they're among the best of the series. And it looks like Jordana Brewster, who plays Mia Toretto, is actually coming back for this movie too. Now, she wasn't in Fate of the Furious because her character was married to Brian O'Connor, Paul Walker's character, and obviously they were written out of the series after Furious 7. And she really hasn't been part of the action since Fast 5 anyway, so I'm really curious to see like what they do with her character, like how they're going to bring her back. You know, if it's just going to be like a one line thing where it's like, oh, Brian's watching the kids, I'm going to join in on this heist. Like, great.
I'm in. Yeah. Thank God I invented that oxygen machine.
Exactly.
I remember talking about how she was basically relegated to nervous mom on the phone for the last two or three movies.
Yeah.
And that's kind of it.
Yeah. And that's a bummer because she's a lot of fun when she's in on the action. Like, I think she's great in Fast Five. She can drive. Like, she drives around with the crew in the first one and the fifth one.
Yeah.
So it's like, why not? Just
everybody. Just everybody's in this movie.
Everybody
now
can drive. Everybody can put everybody in one big clown car. Each with their own steering wheel.
Correct. And just see what happens.
I think it'll be a lot of fun. So yeah, Justin Lin coming back to Fast and Furious. I think that is awesome news. Just really cool. And I'm excited to see, I guess, what he does from here. I mean, I was, you know, he went on to do Star Trek for that. Like, Star Trek Beyond kind of underperformed at the box office. He signed on to a couple of different things, and then now he's back to Fast and Furious. But it is an interesting thing that like a lot of these franchises, we're talking about Creed, we're talking about Star Wars, we're talking about Fast and Furious, they're all bringing back, you know, these people who successfully made movies in the past.
Weird how they decided to do that.
Yeah.
I'm slightly less excited than if this was James Wan returning, but I guess I'm still in for this.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you.
He
on
did
that.
Make the best movies. I mean, James Wan made my favorite one.
Yeah, same. Yeah, I think we're both big fans of Furious 7. That movie is fucking bonkers. And yeah, I mean, I would be more like, I think Justin Lin, Fast 5 and 6 are great. James Wan is a director who I like more, and I'm more interested in what he does. But
yeah,
Justin Lin, I mean, he's a great action director anyway, so excited about that. And then I do have one last bit of film news, Mike, and I kind of just want to touch on this briefly because this has been all over the news over the past month. I don't think we really have that much to add that is of value to the community about this. So I'm going to bring the podcast down for a little bit.
It's our recurring segment of the sad last news story.
Yeah. I mean, it's not somebody dying this time, which is
I mean, I guess there's that, which is nice.
Yeah, but we're referring to the Harvey Weinstein stuff. I mean, that's I don't think we have to spend too much time on this because this is generally a pretty fun podcast, or at least I like to think so. But okay, so Harvey Weinstein has been ousted from the Weinstein Company after dozens, if not hundreds, of women came forward and accused him of sexual assault. And I wanted to talk about this because this kind of created like a snowball effect, and now more is coming out about other powerful people in Hollywood, including director James Toback, who more than 300 women have come out to accuse him, which is just insane.
That's crazy.
Just insane. Amazon chief Roy Price and just today Kevin Spacey, which was definitely upsetting. And I don't have much to say other than that it's fucked up. And
yeah,
and I think this is like only the beginning. I think there are other people who I've heard rumors about for years that I didn't want to believe. And it's likely only a matter of time before more is going to come to light about a lot of people in Hollywood. You know,
this has been one of the things that is kind of, I guess, like an open secret in Hollywood. And people have always talked about that. I feel like anytime you read or hear something about, you know, the old studio system of the 20s and 30s, it was this kind of thing happening then.
Right.
And it's just existed within the system forever, within the bubble of Hollywood. And it seems like it's finally over, or it has the potential to be ousted and ended and finally these people can be punished and pushed out of the industry and whatever happens. And hopefully going forward, that goes away. That doesn't become a thing anymore.
Yeah,
hopefully.
I mean, I'm hoping this is the beginning of like a new phase of Hollywood. I think it's going to take a while. Yeah. You know, obviously it's not just famous people suffering. And I think the hope is that this sparks enough of a national conversation where this culture can be stamped out in other industries as well.
Like it's, exactly, yeah.
But I think one of the most interesting things, I mean, the Harvey Weinstein thing was huge. It dominated the news for a few weeks and is still dominating the news in a lot of cases. Not today. as of this,
our Lord and Savior Mueller is out to get us.
As of this recording, there's some pretty huge shit going on with the Mueller and his indictments. It's pretty great to watch. Mm-hmm. But you know, you've seen people who've worked with Harvey Weinstein in the past, and a lot of people who I admire owe their careers to Harvey Weinstein. Quentin Tarantino, Kevin Smith, these are people who, you know, whose work I'm a huge fan of. And Harvey Weinstein has produced every movie Quentin Tarantino's ever made. And ditto Kevin Smith, or at least for a long time, he produced Kevin Smith's movies. And it's been interesting to watch the reactions from a lot of people about this. Like, you see people like Ben Affleck and Matt Damon, who kind of gave like cursory apologies about it, like very upset about this, like whatever. But they didn't really go that like in depth or anything. They kind of like dismissed it almost. Whereas Quentin Tarantino gave like this really like in depth personal interview. Like he waited a long time to talk about it. I think he had he internalized a lot of it and really like dug deep in himself, and I think it was clear that like he felt guilt about it. I think he said he was dating was it Mira Sorvino, maybe? He was dating an actress in the 90s. It might have been Mira Sorvino, who came out recently and accused Harvey Weinstein about it, and he said that he knew about it back then, that she had told him about it. And I think he said he might have talked to Harvey Weinstein. It's been a little while since, I mean, this is like nearly a few weeks old, so.
Yeah.
Because we haven't recorded a podcast in a while. But, you know, he talked about it very candidly and talked about how the industry has allowed this to happen for a long time. And, he, you know, he didn't absolve himself of any guilt by association with Harvey Weinstein. And I thought that was interesting of him. Kevin Smith, I thought, had a great reaction. I don't know if you heard about this, but, you know, he was very emotional about it. He was torn because, I mean, he owes his entire career to Harvey Weinstein. Harvey Weinstein is the one who discovered Clerks and picked it up. And, you know, Miramax and Weinstein produced most of Kevin Smith's movies throughout the 90s and 2000s. He had this really emotional status update and, you know, video and stuff like that. He talked about it in an interview, and he ended up pledging a donation to, I think he's like donating all the residuals he gets from his movies from here on out that were produced by Weinstein to various women's charities, which was good.
Wow.
And even if those residuals run out, which is a possibility because the Weinstein company may fold in on itself. He's still going to donate like $2,000 a month or something to those things, regardless. So, you know, it's been interesting to see the different reactions coming out about this stuff. But anyway,
yeah. Oh, good.
Well, I just wanted to bring it up because it felt like the elephant in the room in terms of the film news for the.
yeah, it's kind of hard to talk about movie stuff right now without at least acknowledging what's happening.
Yeah.
But like we said, hopefully this does usher in a new era in of Hollywood where we can finally, like you said, have a larger conversation also just as with society as a country about sexual assault and move past all this or work to make a better world, I guess. I don't know what I'm trying to say, but
no, I'm with you. All right. So I think we've talked about that enough. We can move on and get some more fun things happening, Mike, in our discussion.
Watch this. These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my buddy and I talk about movies we see. These are my discussions. There is so much to see, you and me. So we're gonna talk about movies for our discussions.
All right, it's time for our discussions here on Film Bookcast. Mike, what do you have to discuss with us today?
So today I have a few things. I guess I'll discuss the smaller things first, and then we'll have a discussion together about my last thing, because we were a part of it together, Mike.
Oh, yeah, man.
Yeah. We're friends outside of this. That's cool,
it's
isn't it?
Wild.
Yeah. But my first thing is Stranger Things Season 2. Has dropped on Netflix a couple days ago.
Right. Now, you had a really funny status update because you were at a bar, and I guess the bar was playing Stranger Things Season 2.
Yeah, so after work on Friday, which was the day it dropped, October 27th,
yeah.
My coworkers and I decided to go get a drink after work. We walk into the bar. Music's blaring because, well, I guess that's what they do there. I don't know. We look up at the TVs above the bar, and it's like, that's Stranger Things. That's weird. I don't recognize. Oh shit! I don't recognize the scene in Stranger Things season 2. What the fuck? Whoever decided that was a good idea at that bar needs to be fired.
Yeah. How? How? Because
this.
Did you go to a different bar or something? Like, you had...
No, we just were like, okay, and we just moved to, like, somewhere where we couldn't see the TVs from the bar. But it was really distracting for, like, you know, 10 minutes or so.
Yeah.
I kind of glance up at the TV, and it's, like, a really tense-looking scene with lots of people, lots of stuff happening.
Yeah.
And we're all just looking at each other, hands over our eyes, looking at the floor, like, oh, my God, what the fuck? Like, I have no idea what episode it is.
Right.
I was so mad. But that said, I have watched the first two episodes of season two so far.
So have I, actually.
Ooh. And they're cool, I guess. It's kind of more of the same. I think I'm a little more lukewarm on it so far than I was season one.
Really? I'm having more fun with it now.
That's totally fair. And I haven't quite put my finger on why I have that reaction right now. And as I watch the rest of the season, I'm sure I will warm up to it more. But yeah, so that's kind of it. I just wanted to mention that Stranger Things season two is out.
Okay.
I'm excited to keep watching.
Yeah.
I haven't had the chance to binge many episodes this weekend.
Yeah, I mean, I've only watched the first two. But yeah, I mean, like, you were a huge fan of Stranger Things season one.
Yeah. Season one was made for me, it felt.
Yeah, I mean, you listed that as your favorite show of last year, I remember, in our best of list. And I felt that season one, like, I don't know, it felt like I liked it. But also, like, it was, like, empty nostalgia porn to me.
Mm-hmm. That's fair.
And I feel like I didn't – that feeling for me hasn't gone away. But I don't know. I'm enjoying it more than I did season one, at least for these first two episodes. You know, I'm eager to see what happens, I guess. Like, it's more of a thing where I'm just like, oh, I'll pop on Stranger Things. Like, whatever.
I do simultaneously appreciate and am annoyed by how they just flaunt their new budget. How, like, every scene is a new smash hit 80s song that, like, they can afford music rights to now. So it's just like, sure, drop that song in, and 45 seconds later, we're playing a new song.
Right.
It's just like, all right, sure, I guess.
Yeah, fair enough. I did see one really funny tweet, which was that I think it was from Sean O'Neill from the AV Club, who said something along the lines of, like, okay, I can accept Demigorgons, I can accept all these crazy shit, these parallel dimensions, the Upside Down that goes on in Stranger Things, but bullshit did anyone ever make it that far in Dragon's Lair.
That too, yeah, all the arcade video game references and everything all of a sudden, which is cool. That's fine. And then my other discussion, or my second discussion, is another Netflix original series called Mindhunter.
Okay, I'm excited to watch this.
Yeah, I have only watched the pilot, the first episode. There's 10 episodes in season one.
Yeah.
This came out a little while ago, I think.
A couple weeks ago.
Yeah, a couple weeks ago. And it I'm trying to look it up because I should have looked this up right before we started. Directed by David Fincher? David Fincher's involved somehow.
Yeah, David Fincher directed, I think, the first two episodes and the last two episodes.
Okay, yeah. And it is a, as you would assume, David Fincher with a show called Mindhunter. It's about serial killers, just like you would have thought. It's set in the late 70s, about a FBI hostage negotiator who gets reassigned to a different department or whatever. And it's just the pilot is about his inner turmoil about the kind of burgeoning psychology of the late 70s and in the criminal psyche, and how that can be used, you know, in regards to the FBI and tracking serial killers and all that stuff. And it's fucking cool. It's just, I've only watched one episode, and it's just David Fincher doing his David Fincher thing about serial killers. Nice. In the 70s. Like, what more do you need? So definitely excited to watch more of that, and it's probably going to end up being one of my favorite shows so far, I think. I'll go out on a limb and say that.
Based on one episode, I can already guarantee.
Based on the premise, the equation that is this show, I think it's going to equal Mike enjoys this. So that's my two discussions. Then my third discussion is a big event that you and I went to at the Alamo Drafthouse in Yonkers.
Yes.
Last weekend. And we went to see Dismember the Alamo.
Yes.
Or that was the event we went to, which was a 5 mystery movie horror marathon. And we just went in totally blind, which was cool, which is, you know, to compare it to Hudson Horror Show, which is the only other thing we talked about that on the podcast when we went to that back in May. where we knew all, or we knew four of the five movies or whatever it was. Yeah, there was one mystery movie.
Yeah, there was one mystery. I think we watched six that day, and there was five that we knew, one that was a mystery movie.
So just remember the Alamo, to go in totally blind to five movies was really cool for me. I've never had that experience, going to a mystery movie marathon.
Right.
And the movies were all really cool. We saw some really interesting stuff. You know, the Alamo doing its 35 millimeter prints, thing. So we got to see some cool rare stuff. I think the second movie, which was Brian De Palma's Sisters. We'll list all the movies, I guess.
Yeah.
They mentioned that it was the only print in the United States that we got to watch, which is fucking dope. So why don't you list the movies, Mike?
Sure, yeah. I mean, the first movie was Wes Craven's The People Under the Stairs, which was really cool. I had never seen that before, and that's a Wes Craven movie I hadn't seen, so I was pretty excited about that. And that was really fun. It's a horror movie, but it's also like sort of an action comedy. And it features two actors from Twin Peaks, Big Ed Hurley and Nadine. playing completely like opposite roles that they do in Twin Peaks. Like Big Ed Hurley. I'm blanking. Everett McGill, I think, is the actor's name. He's fucking going nuts in this movie. And
he's so stoic and like stiff upper lip as Big Ed. Yeah. In this movie, he's running around in a gimp suit, just blowing holes in a wall with a shotgun.
He's like dancing and celebrating. He's like, I got him, and it's pretty amazing. And also, Ving Rhames is in it, and he's great in it too. He's pretty funny.
This breaking and entering might not be so smart. I mean, it's the first day of my 13th birthday. Could be unlucky.
13th birthday is unlucky anyway. Too old to get tit, too young to get ass. Fucked out of the way.
Anyway, so that's People Under the Stairs. And then we saw Sisters, the Brian De Palma movie. I think that was my favorite one of the night.
I think so too.
Which was just a really great psychological thriller featuring Margot Kidder, who played Lois Lane in these Superman films. Just a really, really phenomenal movie. And then after that, we watched, it was called Dead People on the Print. It's also known as Messiah of Evil, which is from 1973. And it's a really relatively obscure, I believe, Canadian horror movie that is directed by Willard Huyck and Gloria Katz, who are the duo best known as the people who made 1986's Howard the Duck, should probably not be their legacy, because this movie, I mean... this is a really a tough movie to find, and it was the print that was in the worst shape of the night, in terms of the 35 millimeter quality. But I'd heard about them talk about this on Pure Cinema podcast a while back, and is actually, I think it was for their Code Red DVD episode. So you can go listen to that if you want to. But I mean, it was interesting. It was an interesting movie. I think it has some phenomenal scenes. I feel like partially I might like it more if I had watched it outside of the context of a marathon, just because I think, you're wedging a movie in the middle of these, you get tired by around movie three or four. And so it's, And so for a movie to like Messiah of Evil, which is relatively slow paced, it's kind of hard to keep focus. But I mean, there was a lot of really interesting stuff going on in that movie. And then the fourth movie we watched was the biggest troll move of all time.
I was really glad to have figured it out, though.
So before every movie, there was two trailers for other movies that would play before the movie that we watched. And those trailers would kind of give you a hint as to the movie you were going to see. So before People on the Stairs, we saw two Wes Craven trailers, I think, right? So it was we're going to watch a Wes Craven movie now. I'm like, cool. But when they intro'd the movie, they were like, so the movie we're about to watch, I'm a little nervous about this one because I really like it, but it's the kind of movie where for every person that likes it, there's three people who hate it. It's a guy who has only ever directed one movie, but it's a really interesting one. I think you're going to really dig it. And they go away. And the trailers start playing. And it's the trailer for Stephen King's Children of the Corn. And then you turn to me and you're like, oh, shit. They're going to play Maximum Overdrive. And I was like, nah, there's no way. But in the back of my mind, I'm like, wait. Stephen King directed Maximum Overdrive, and it's the only movie he directed.
Yep.
It could be. And then the next trailer was for Stephen King's Lawnmower Man, and I was like, no shit, they're playing Maximum Overdrive.
Honey, come on over here, sugar buns. This machine just called me an asshole.
So, yeah, for those of you who don't know what Maximum Overdrive is, it's the movie that Stephen King directed in the 80s when he was high on coke all the time, and it shows. Mm-hmm. Essentially, it's an adaptation of his short story called Trucks, which is about these like every electronic device on the planet goes haywire and comes to life and starts attacking humans. And in this instance, a bunch of humans get holed up in a truck stop and are being circled by these trucks that are killing them. And it's exactly as silly as that sounds. And it has a soundtrack by none other than AC/DC, which is the cherry on top for this movie. It's the reason I had seen this movie before, because when I was 13, I was a huge AC/DC fan. Me and my friend rented Maximum Overdrive and watched this movie.
That's amazing.
And back then, we were like, man, this sucks. and watching it at the Dismember the Alamo show, it was like, oh, okay, this still sucks.
Yeah, but it was a lot of fun, I think.
I agree. Yeah, it was fun to watch in a theater with like a crowded theater with people who were laughing at it and having fun, and like it's such a silly, like cheesy movie, and yeah. I don't know. That was definitely like the wild card of the night for me. I was like, wow, I cannot believe I watched Maximum Overdrive tonight. Did not see that one coming, for sure.
Mm-hmm. And I can't remember what the fifth movie is now that I'm trying to think about it. Really?
It was probably my second favorite one after Sisters. It was the Slumber Party Massacre.
Oh, yes, that's right. Okay.
So for this one, this was like their tribute to female directors, because there's very few female horror directors, especially in the 80s. Right. And the Slumber Party Massacre series, there's three of them, all of which were directed by female directors, all of which were also produced by Roger Corman, I believe. And this is just a really great – I really liked The Slumber Party Massacre. This is from like 1982, and it's exactly what it sounds like. It's a slumber party massacre. Girls at a slumber party. There's a serial killer coming in, and it's also like I think really effectively written, which I think is what makes it work so well. It's pretty sharp, like kind of satirical piece, like kind of making fun of these kind of slasher movies, but at the same time working really well as an entry in the slasher genre. So to that end, I really enjoyed Slumber Party Massacre, and that was the last movie that we saw at Dismember the Alamo.
Yeah, I think Sisters is my favorite. Was my favorite like film nerd choice for the evening, and it was I think the coolest movie. But Slumber Party Massacre was I'm upset with myself for having forgot it. that was such a interesting, like you said, a satire of just slasher movies, and just for having a female director, there was so much like send up of the slasher genre, where we have the gratuitous group shower scene where we have just random lingering shots on butts everywhere, right, and stuff like that. But it was a really fun taut slasher movie on top of all of that. So that was definitely really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was Dismember the Alamo. I was surprised by the selection of movies because I expected, I don't know, when I hear Dismember the Alamo, I figure like nonstop gore fest. That was like the idea.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I pictured. And you kind of get that with Slumber Party Massacre. But I think every other movie that we watched, it wasn't really that, it was a lot more psychological stuff than it was. I mean, at least with Sisters and Messiah of Evil, definitely. And then People Under the Stairs, it's almost like this like kids adventure movie.
It's such a, I think they said it came out in 91 or 92. 91. It's such a early 90s Wes Craven horror movie. Right. Just like when you think that, you get People Under the Stairs.
Yes.
And it's just such a silly, bombastic.
Yeah, because I mean, he was making. He made like New Nightmare around the same time, and Scream was coming a couple years later. So he was in that mode where he was like kind of getting more playful and meta in that regard, and getting a little more comedic. So the People on the Stairs kind of falls in that category. It's not like meta in the same way, but I think it is aware of horror tropes and plays around with them a little bit. But yeah. Anyway, that was Dismember the Alamo. It was a blast. I hope to go again next year. Supposedly they might expand it to 6 movies next year. Wild. So we'll see what happens. But anyway, yeah, I have some other stuff to discuss today, Mike. So we got to get through those before we get into Blade Runner. I saw a few movies over the past month or so, and the first of which is called Happy Death Day.
I feel like I'm losing my mind.
You sneaky little biatch.
Happy birthday.
I've already lived through this day.
Somebody's gonna kill me tonight.
The new slasher movie from Blumhouse, directed by Christopher B. Landon. And I think it's pretty solid. It's a pretty funny like slasher for teens. It's essentially What If Groundhog Day, but a horror movie. And
amazing.
This is another like pretty big Blumhouse hit. It had a budget of $5 million. Has currently grossed $68 million. And it's kind of cemented Blumhouse as like I think it might be like the most remarkable studio working today. Like every year they come out with like 10 or 12 movies a year, and half of them don't make any money. But since they spend barely anything on them, they can pretty much just write them off. And then, like, the other half of them are, like, massive hits.
Yeah.
You know, like, this past year they've had Split, Get Out, and Happy Death Day. Like, the Split and Get Out were huge. Get Out especially was, like, you know, it's it might get nominated for Best Picture at the Oscars this year. Like, that's kind of what people are talking about.
Oh, my God, please.
That would be insane. But, like, it could happen. Like, it's got that level of critical acclaim. And, you know, Happy Death Day is not in anywhere near as good as Get Out. But it's a really fun, like, it's mildly clever. It is aware of its tropes. Like I said before, People Under the Stairs. Like, it has fun with its premise. Does different, interesting things. It has a pretty great ending. I liked the ending quite a bit, actually. So definitely, right. I think worth checking out. It's like a PG-13 horror movie aimed at teens. So, you know, you kind of get what you pay for. It's not like gory or anything. Like, it's kind of implied gore a lot of the time. I would recommend Happy Death Day. I think it's pretty fun. Also wanted to talk about Spielberg, which is the new HBO documentary directed by Susan Lacy about the life and career of Steven Spielberg. And I really, really enjoyed this because I am exactly in the target audience for this movie. But it's 2.5 hours long and it barely scratches the surface of Spielberg's career. I mean, this should be like a 10-hour miniseries as far as I'm concerned.
A Ken Burns special.
Yeah, I mean, there was just so much ground to cover. And yeah, this movie covers quite a bit, but not enough. Like, I just feel like there's more. Like, at least make a sequel or something. It mostly covers the hits, you know. It covers Jaws, covers Close Encounters, it covers, you know, Jurassic Park, and, you know, a lot of the big ones. And then it spends some time on the other ones you don't know as much about. It spends some time on Spielberg's life, and there's a lot of really interesting stuff going on there. It talks about his childhood, and, you know, so much of his movies were informed by his parents' divorce when he was a kid. But, you know, I didn't know some of the other details about that. And so he was talking about how he reconciled with his dad later on in life, and he found out that the reason his parents got divorced was because his mom was cheating on his dad with his best friend. And that ended up working into the plot of Catch Me If You Can, where Christopher Walken's character reveals that to Leonardo DiCaprio, his son in that movie.
Wow.
So it's really interesting stuff going on there. But also this does have some really interesting stuff going on, recounting Spielberg's early days, where he's hanging out with the movie brats. It's like him, George Lucas, Francis Ford Coppola, Brian De Palma, and Martin Scorsese. Like, before they all made it big, they're just like all hanging out in Los Angeles together. There's some behind the scenes footage of that. There's this amazing story where Spielberg is recounting the time that George Lucas showed them all Star Wars for the first time, like before anybody else had seen it. So he's talking about how they saw Star Wars and like a lot of the effects weren't finished and stuff. So George Lucas like intercut it with like footage from World War II to show the battle scenes and stuff like that.
Wow.
And it's really cool stuff. And then he describes Brian De Palma's reaction to Star Wars. Brian De Palma fucking hated it. and you know, they, you know, cause they're all trying to give like their honest feedback to George Lucas. And Brian De Palma is talking about like, you know, they all go out to dinner and Brian De Palma just goes off and he's like, you know, none of this made sense. I don't understand any of the story behind any of these characters. What the fuck is this talking dog thing that's going on? This like gigantic, you know, dog creature. And then he actually, Spielberg said that, De Palma actually said to George Lucas, you need to put some kind of words at the beginning of the movie to describe what is happening so people understand what this movie's about. And that's how the opening crawl for Star Wars came about.
Wow. That's crazy.
Yeah. And so this Spielberg documentary does have a lot of stuff like that. And it is really cool to check out. I just wish there was more of it. Like, I, at 2.5 hours, like, I was never bored. I wanted more.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, that's you talking about Spielberg.
This is true.
For you.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So I'm a bit of a Spielberg fanatic. But I do feel like this movie, like, it does a lot of good stuff with Spielberg. There is more to do. Like, I wish it had covered, you know, more of the flops in Spielberg's career. Like, I wish it had covered more, like, it talked about 1941 a little bit, which, you know, is this comedy movie that he made after Close Encounters. And, you know, I wish it would have talked a little bit more about Poltergeist and how, like, whether he or Toby Hooper were the ones who actually directed that movie. I wish it had gone a little more into Temple of Doom, which is a movie that, you know, is so tonally different from the other Indiana Jones movies, because Spielberg was going through a divorce at the time. And it's like, there's like, it kind of glosses over the imperfect stuff in Spielberg's life
to right.
kind of, show you like all the big, like, momentous hits and stuff. And it's really effective at doing that. But I really would have liked to see more stuff going on throughout. But it does do a lot of really great stuff. I mean, there's great stuff about Lincoln. It pretty much goes all the way up through Bridge of Spies. There's actually some footage from BFG in there too. But it shows you like some behind the scenes footage of Bridge of Spies and stuff like that. So well worth checking out if you're any kind of Spielberg fan. But if you're any kind of film geek, I think like you're a fan of Spielberg in general. So
yeah.
And there's other stuff like outside of the realm of Spielberg to be interested in this movie. Like I was saying with the De Palma Star Wars thing, it's pretty wild. Anyway, that's the Spielberg doc. I have a couple other movies to talk about. The first of which is A Ghost Story, which is the new movie from director David Lowery, who first came onto the scene a couple years ago with Ain't Them Body Saints, with Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara. And then last year he directed Pete's Dragon for Disney, which I maintain is still the best of the Disney remakes of their old stuff.
The live-action remakes?
Yeah, exactly. And this movie reunites David Lowery with Rooney Mara and Casey Affleck. And it is real damn good. Like, it is just real damn good. So, Rudy Merritt and Casey Affleck play a couple in this movie. Have you heard about this movie at all, Mike?
I have heard about it. I know a single, I think it's the poster, the kid in the ghost sheet. And that's it. That's all I know about this movie.
Well, that's not a kid.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
The plot of this movie is that Rooney Mara and Casey Affleck are a couple. Affleck dies in an accident and comes back as a ghost. And it's literally a sheet with two eyelids.
okay. Amazing.
And it kind of just proceeds to that ghost kind of proceeds to just observe the world while stuck in one place, his old house. And, you know, much of it is told without words. It's told very silently. Rooney Mara is just incredible. And this movie hits emotional depths that you just would never expect it to hit. Like there was no point where I felt like I knew what was going to happen next. And by the time the movie gets to its ending, I was like, holy shit, this is kind of unreal what I'm watching right now. So
yes.
A Ghost Story, very much worth checking out. I think David Lowery is a really talented filmmaker, and this is definitely one to go see. I actually haven't seen Ain't Them Body Saints, and I kind of want to go back and watch that now. I believe that's on Netflix, so going to have to check that out when I get a chance. And then the other movie I saw this weekend was The Florida Project.
It's only second week of the summer, and there's already been a dead fish in the pool.
We're trying to get it back alive.
Water balloons thrown at tourists.
Mother Mooney, you
disgrace.
Which is a new movie directed by Sean Baker, who directed a movie a couple years ago called Tangerine, which I also missed and I meant to watch. I heard great things about. That's on Netflix too, I think. But this is a new drama about small kids growing up in a poverty-stricken hotel in Florida, just around the corner from Disney World. And this is a very good film, featuring like a great against-type performance from Willem Dafoe. Willem Dafoe is like next-level great in this movie.
Wow.
And I'm not sure it really sticks the landing in the end. It kind of goes off into this alternates, and like it's a very odd ending, but I think for the most part it's a pretty effective work. Also, your boy Macon Blair makes a quick appearance.
My boy, I gotta see it then.
it's for like one scene, but he's pretty good in the scene. So I did want to briefly mention The Florida Project. I feel like I wasn't as crazy about it as a lot of people were. This movie's been getting really positive reviews across the board, but I did enjoy it quite a bit. Or enjoy it kind of a different, not really the word to use, but I was affected by it.
Right.
Although there's a lot of funny moments, so whatever. Finally, I want to give a shout out to The Deuce, which is the HBO drama from David Simon, the creator of The Wire, that just wrapped up its season last night. And have you seen anything about The Deuce, Mike? Are you familiar with the show at all?
I know the basic premise that it's about Times Square in the 70s, I believe, maybe the 80s. I don't remember.
Yeah.
It in its seedy underbelly past before it was the tourist trap it is now.
I mean, this show is essentially about the sex workers that birthed the porn industry in 70s New York. So when you're talking about seedy, yes, it's definitely seedy. And it's pretty great. I mean, there's not much of an overall story in this show as much as it is like just a slice of life with these characters. But it's got James Franco doing really great work in a dual role. He plays brothers in the show. And one of the great pleasures of the show is just watching James Franco insult himself like back and forth. It's pretty phenomenal. And Maggie Gyllenhaal is also great in this show too. She plays a prostitute who starts to get into the porn industry and then becomes kind of enamored with the process of actually making the movies. And so kind of becomes the first female porn director. And it's really interesting on that front. And there's a lot of like really great performances just across the board. Lawrence Gilliatt Jr. from The Walking Dead is in the show as well. He played Bob on The Walking Dead. Zoe Kazan is in a couple episodes as well. And it's good stuff. Actually, speaking of The Walking Dead, might as well throw this out there. The first two episodes of The Walking Dead, eighth season, it premiered, and I've watched them. And they are about as boring as you would expect.
Man, you had such high hopes, I felt.
Yeah, I mean, it was, I was kind of looking forward to the new season just to see, because I went to the Walking Dead panel, and I was like, yeah, you know, it's the Walking Dead, whatever. But the panel kind of got me jazzed up. I was like, oh, they're talking about how the show's going to be more quickly paced this season and stuff like that. And, like, it kind of is. You know, it's pretty much, like, these last two episodes have been pretty much nonstop battles and action and stuff, but there's been no, like, context for it. It's just been, like... You know,
okay.
Mindless, yeah. Action, like it's like they're infiltrating all these buildings, and I'm like, but why are they doing this? Like, you know, there's no real reason for it other than like they're attacking Negan, and it's like, all right, but is there like a plan here, or like what? Like, I don't understand.
The pace is too quick. There's not enough time, Mike.
It's not even that the pace is too quick. It's just very incomprehensibly told.
all right, fair.
But I do want to shout out the first episode of The Walking Dead, because it literally opens up. It's the premiere of this episode of the season. It's also the 100th episode of the show. And what better way to open the new season of The Walking Dead, the 100th episode of your show, than with Weird Al Yankovic's Another One Rides the Bus? Because that's what this show did. And
wow.
It was kind of weird. And it wasn't just in that one, in an opening scene. It was prominently featured throughout the episode.
What an interesting choice.
Yeah, it was very strange. It was like in these weird flash forwards. So they kind of like cut back to the flash forwards throughout the episode. And I'm thinking they might do it throughout the season. and if that's the case, I'll have to keep watching because I love Weird Al.
Yeah, they got you. That was the one thing that it could take, and they did it.
I can't believe it. Yeah, anyway, that's The Walking Dead. That's The Deuce. Those are all the movies we talked about. We had a lot of discussions this week, Mike.
Yeah, it was a very long segment.
Very long. Very long indeed. I'm out of breath. So we got to move on, Mike. Let's get into our featured review of Blade Runner 2049.
Every civilization was built off the back of a disposable workforce. But I can only make so many. Shh. Happy birthday.
There is an order to things. That's what we do here. We keep order. The world is built on a wall that separates kind. Tell either side there's no wall. You bought a war.
You're a cop. I had your job once. I was good at it.
I know.
What do you want?
I want to ask you some questions.
All right, that was from the trailer for Blade Runner 2049, written by Hampton Francher and Michael Green, and directed by Denis Villeneuve. This stars Ryan Gosling, Harrison Ford, Ana de Armas, Sylvia Hulks, Robin Wright, Mackenzie Davis, Carla Yuri, Lenny James, Dave Bautista, and Jared Leto, among others. And the IMDb plot synopsis for Blade Runner 2049 reads, a young Blade Runner's discovery of a long-buried secret leads him to track down former Blade Runner Rick Deckard, who has been missing for 30 years. Now, Mike, I've seen the original Blade Runner a couple of times, though only as the final cut. I'm curious what your thoughts are on the original movie before we get into Blade Runner 2049.
Yeah, have I never talked about it on the podcast before? I don't remember. I just watched it, the final cut version, for the first time a couple months ago, I believe.
Really?
Yeah. It's been one of those movies that's just kind of in the cultural consciousness, I guess, and I just never got around to it. Okay. I felt like I just knew enough about it. That's like a weird way to phrase that, but that's how I think about things sometimes. So I finally sat down, watched it. It was definitely a sight to behold. I don't know if it was something that I particularly loved or enjoyed a whole lot.
Okay.
That said, I did definitely appreciate it as a work. You know, there, you can make that distinction, I think, between some really loving something but also not really loving something, but also appreciating it for what it is. And just as a fan of noir and all of its shapes and forms, it was really cool. And I do love that kind of cyberpunk, just it's raining all the time because we killed the Earth vibe. just that whole weird type of genre. That said, though, it's like I said, it wasn't something I particularly loved. But I was expecting to love Blade Runner 2049 just because of the assembly of talent in it. Denis Villeneuve, I've talked about a whole bunch of times, is one of my favorite directors going on right now, working right now. I have fallen in love with Ryan Gosling because how could you not look at him? We had Harrison Ford back, and I was just pumped for whatever Denis Villeneuve and the team could do to the world and story of Blade Runner. And I think they basically delivered a movie that will be incredibly hard for Villeneuve or any of them to top. I think this might be the masterpiece movie. I just saw today somewhere that they talked about there was once a 4-hour cut of this film that has been destroyed and not talked about anymore, which is tragic because I want it now. I want it in my eyeballs.
Yeah. So I'll back up a little bit. I'm kind of with you on the original Blade Runner. I've seen it a couple of times, only as the final cut version. Although I've watched clips of the theatrical cut on YouTube just to see what the narration is like. And the narration, man, it's bad.
Is it really? That's what I've heard. I've heard that.
It's real bad. Like, I thought that was being – like, I heard people talk about that. I thought they were over-exaggerating. I was just like, people just don't like voiceover in movies. Like, I'm sure it's not that bad. If you look it up on YouTube, Harrison Ford is, like, out the door.
I'd quit because I'd had a belly full of killing. But then I'd rather be a killer than a victim. And that's exactly what Bryant's threat about little people meant. So I hooked in once more, thinking that if I couldn't take it, I'd split later. I didn't have to worry about Gaff. He was brown-nosing for a promotion, so he didn't want me back anyway.
Yeah, I've also heard that Harrison Ford has since said, I don't remember when, if this might just be one of those weird myths, that he hated it, so he just he phoned it in on purpose and tanked the voiceover so it would be bad.
Yes, I believe that's
true. So interesting choice, Mr. Ford, I guess.
But anyway, yeah, so I've only seen it as the final cut. Most recently I saw it in a 4K restoration at the Alamo Drafthouse.
That would be cool.
Yeah, that was back in April and it was beautiful. It's a movie that I admire quite a bit. And I like it a lot, but I just find myself just outside of the cult of people who really, really love it, you know?
Yeah.
But the proposition of a sequel to Blade Runner always seemed really dubious to me because the original ends on a very ambiguous note. But I got more excited when they got Denis Villeneuve on board. Also, Hampton Francher co-wrote this one and he wrote the original screenplay. And, you know, Denis Villeneuve, one of the most original directors working today. I know you're a huge fan of him. I think what's amazing about this movie is that it feels so different from the original, yet it also feels like it's a piece with that world. Like, it feels like it's the world that was presented in Blade Runner, but filtered through Denis Villeneuve's sensibility. And I think that's kind of the big distinction to make. And it explores new ideas, or it expands on the ideas of the first one. It arguably has more of a story hook for the audience to latch onto, I think. The first – if you put a gun to my head, I don't think I could really recount the story of the original Blade Runner to you.
No, it's very much not about that.
Yeah, the basic plot of Blade Runner is kind of murky. I can kind of give you Roy Batty's an evil dude, the bad replicant, and, he's trying to – he's trying to live or whatever. I get the basic gist when I'm watching it, but it's really difficult to explain, I guess, is what I'm saying. But this movie, it feels more clear cut in terms of what its plot actually is. Also, the movie just looks flat out amazing. Cinematographically.
my other boy Roger Deakins showed up.
Yeah, Roger Deakins, best cinematographer working today, period. It's a goddamn crime he has not won an Oscar yet. I think
this has to be the one, right?
This has to be the one. I cannot fathom another movie this year winning the Oscar for best cinematography. Another movie probably will, but just because Roger Deakins is cursed to walk the earth without an Oscar forevermore. Whatever deal with the devil he made to be awesome at cinematography, it cost him his Oscar, I think is what happens.
Pretty much.
This movie looks unlike anything that has been out in theaters this year. It's really kind of a sight to behold. I really feel like the only thing the movie is missing is a performance that is as dynamic as Rutger Hauer's in the first movie. When I was watching the original Blade Runner last April at the Draft House, that was the thing that stuck out to me the most, that Rutger Hauer is next level great. I think it's one of my favorite performances of all time in that movie. And I think everyone here is good, or they're even great. There are some great performances in here, actually. But Rutger Hauer as Roy Batty is just next level. I mean, his ending monologue is one of the most iconic things I've ever, it's unbeatable.
I've
seen things you people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. I watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Tannhauser Gate. All those moments will be lost in time. Like tears in rain. Time to die.
But outside of that, I think this movie is, like, superior to the original Blade Runner, which almost seems like sacrilege to say. Because Blade Runner has been such a, you know, iconic cinematic work for 35 years now, or at least, I mean, maybe not 35 years. The movie came out 35 years ago, was not really a hit, and kind of started to develop a cult following around like 92 when the director's cut first hit. So maybe like 25 years, it's been kind of the cinematic thing. Even then, like, it's never been more than like a cult. You know, like, people are into Blade Runner, people like it a lot, and it's kind of respected in that regard, but. I think the general audiences don't care that much about Blade Runner, which is why it's shocking that this movie exists, you know?
Yeah, I can't believe that this even happened. Yeah. And that it happened to this degree is just amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like this is definitely a case of the studio wanting to revitalize any license they have. You know, and that could have been anything. You know, it could have been a Transformers thing. They could have turned Blade Runner into like a Transformers-esque franchise or whatever. Made it like hugely action-packed and CGI and stuff like that. Hired like somebody like Michael Bay to direct it, and it might have made money and it might have turned, you know, the Blade Runner like into like this viable franchise. Instead, they hired Denis Villeneuve, and he actually like he is such I mean, I've read a lot of interviews with him. He's such a huge Blade Runner fan. And he was talking about why he took the job, and he was like, the reason he took the job was, well, if I didn't take it, someone else was going to, and it might be somebody who didn't care about Blade Runner as much as I do.
And what a noble cause to take this, for a noble reason for him to take this movie.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure, like, the money probably had something to do with it, too. But
like, it doesn't hurt.
But, like, I think that is kind of remarkable, and, you know, so there's clear passion from Denis Villeneuve going into this movie. And now you said that you think this is Denis Villeneuve's masterpiece. Like, you're, and Arrival was your favorite movie last year.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to have to do some research, some comparative viewing, I think. But I think just the Arrival arrived at just the right time in my life, in the world, when that movie came out last year, that it just affected me so deeply. But I think just in terms of just artistic scope, Blade Runner 2049 might be the more landmark of more landmark film for him in his career.
Yeah, no, I think I'm with you on that one. I think I do like this more than Arrival, and I'm somebody who I feel like I've never been as I'm really interested in what Villeneuve does, but I feel like I haven't been as big on him as you have in the past. Like, I mean, Arrival was a huge movie for you. I know Sicario was a huge movie for you as well.
Yeah.
And I liked both those movies a lot, but I really do feel like Blade Runner 2049 just feels like just another step up, you know, another level of filmmaking. And it's really cool to see. And it just feels like this movie should not exist, right?
No. Yeah.
This is a very slow-paced, 2-hour and 45-minute sci-fi movie based on a cult movie from 35 years ago. There's no reason why this movie exists. Like, the studio should not have spent, you know, $150 million on making this movie. And I think it did, like, the movie kind of underperformed at the box office. It didn't do what people were expecting it to do. I think it did make back its budget, because there is, like, enough interest. I think they had Ryan Gosling and Harrison Ford, who are, like, pretty big stars. And it looked really interesting from the trailers. But also, like, there was this kind of, like, this hugely anti-spoiler vibe you get from the trailers. Well, the trailers told you nothing about the story. Mm-hmm. And on the one hand, that's great, because I don't want to know anything about the story. But, like, general audiences who are not familiar with Blade Runner might want to know a little bit about what the movie's about, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I also dragged my parents to see this with me.
Yeah.
And they kind of were there. I remember their initial interest was like, yeah, I remember the first one. It was weird. I don't know if I liked it. I don't even remember if I liked it or not.
Something about unicorns or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they knew a little more than that, but yeah, I definitely warned them going in though that it's going to be, it's 2 hours and 45 minutes. It's going to be weird as shit. It's going to be real slow paced. Just buckle up. And they came out of it with that reaction of, you know, not being, you know, quote unquote film nerds or anything like that. But they're definitely avid movie fans. And they were like, yeah, you were right. It was real weird, real slow. they liked it. They dug it. They thought it was cool and interesting. But they were just like, this was over my head. I don't know how I feel about it. So I always kind of use them as a bit of a gauge against, you know, general, maybe a little more a step up in intermediate general audience, you know, a little bit above. Yeah, the average right. person, I think.
That's right. I use my mom as that too.
Exactly.
It's good that we can use our parents for our own.
At least they're good for something.
To try to relate to other humans. It's that's nice. Anyway, yeah. So we should talk about other stuff in the actual movie itself. I mean, so I don't really want to get into super story specifics until we get into spoilers. But there is something that is revealed very upfront at the beginning of the movie, so I don't think it's quite a spoiler to say that Kay is a replicant, right? Ryan Gosling's right. character is a replicant. And I think that choice alone just completely changes the tone of this movie compared to the first one. Whereas in the first one, it's played kind of ambiguously. Like, what's interesting about the question of whether Deckard is a replicant or not in the original movie is that, you know, that's not really something the movie like poses in the text. Like it's never something the movie actually asks the audience, you know, while you're watching it. It's kind of something that audiences have kind of picked up afterwards.
I've read some kind of discussions or whatever you want to call it about the differences between the theatrical cut. Apparently that's not even a thing. That doesn't even exist. Right. But as Ridley Scott has made his director's cut and then the final cut, he has inserted that more and more into the final cut. I feel like it's pretty it's left as a question mark, but I feel like it's pretty obvious where Deckard falls, that he's just a replicant, right. I think, in the final cut.
Right.
You know, he gets that weird eye glow thing that only replicants have at some point, I believe.
That does happen at one point, yeah. But I think that the fact that does make this kind of significant, like within the first 5 minutes, you're aware that Kay is a replicant. I think Dave, and it's kind of just played like, it's not like revealed to you like, oh, you are a replicant. Like, it's not like, it's not saying like, oh, as a replicant, I like to believe.
Yeah.
Like, it's in that opening scene with Batista, and Batista like says something like, so how do you feel about taking down your own kind or something like that? Like, it's kind of just passed on conversation. Like, if you miss that line, you might like miss that entire thing you might have missed that for a long time. So I think that I think that changes a lot about how you approach the main character in this movie. And specifically, I think that plays out really well in the relationship between Ryan Gosling and his AI Joy.
Right.
Which may have been my favorite part of this movie. I think it was very clearly influenced by Spike Jonze's Her. In a lot of respect, but it kind of takes that concept and presents it in a different light. And I think that was pretty cool. Also, I feel like there was a pretty big Children of Men influence on this movie too. I kind of got that vibe as well from the. I mean, we'll talk about these story specifics and spoilers, but there is just the actual plot of the movie
kind
of mirrors the plot of Children of Men in some ways. But is there any aspects of the movie you want to talk about before we get into spoilers, Mike?
I don't really think so. Without getting into specifics about stuff, I think you talked about having a clear cut plot mystery going on definitely enhances this film as compared to the first one.
Right.
Just all of the general just aesthetic of everything about this movie is so fucking cool. As sad as it is that we're like farming grubs or whatever we're doing in the beginning there. That you know, then like how there's a long tracking shot earlier in the film, I think during like the opening credits or something like that, where the car and, you know, is flying over all the solar farms, and it's just endless solar farms. It's just fucking cool. I don't know, it's just that whole genre, that aesthetic of that is right up my alley, basically. So yeah, that's kind of it. I guess it's time to move into spoilers.
All right, yeah. And before we get into spoilers, I do want to say Blade Runner 2049, if you come away with this review with anything, Blade Runner 2049 is a movie that is so good even Jared Leto can't ruin it. That's
oh shit, I forgot. Yeah, we'll talk about him. Yep.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in spoilers starting right now.
Stop it! Stop it! Stop it! Both of you! You're spoiling it! You're spoiling everything!
All right, so spoilers for Blade Runner 2049 starting right now. So I do want to talk about Harrison Ford a little bit in this movie because, you know, he is all over the marketing in this movie. Like, he's prominently featured on the poster. You know, his name is right there, right upside with Gosling. He does not appear until maybe the last half hour of of this 2 hour and 45 minute movie. And he's good when he shows up. Like, I think he's really interesting. He does a lot of really interesting stuff. He's in his pajamas, which is weird.
Just living that Ford life.
I feel like that was the, like, he agreed to be in the movie, but his one contract stipulation was he had to be able to wear what he wore to bed that night.
Yeah, I gotta be in my jammies.
But it does make you wish that he was not in the marketing of the movie, because how crazy would it be if, like, you didn't know anything about Harrison Ford being in this movie, right?
Oh,
like,
man.
Not on the trailer, not on the poster, or anything like that. Like, Harrison Ford just shows up, and you're like, holy shit! It's
happening. That would have been dope.
And I think they might have been able to get away with that, too, because I can't imagine he was filming on this movie for that long. You know, he was he's not in that much of the movie. Maybe, like, a week or so he was probably filming for this. So it's like, you know, you keep that under wraps. Like, it could happen. Like, I don't know. That surprise of Deckard finally showing up would have been amazing, because the entire movie is Gosling searching for Deckard. So if, like, Deckard showed up, like, you're kind of building this anticipation, like, is Harrison Ford in this movie? Like, is this going to happen? Like, is this really going to be?
Yeah.
But in any case, like, when you're watching it the first time, at least, you're kind of just waiting for Harrison Ford to show up, I think, at that point, because you know he's in the movie. So I think watching it the second time, I'll be able to, it was kind of like when I saw The Force Awakens for the first time, because, like, I feel like I was waiting for Mark Hamill to show up for a lot of the running time of that movie. And then he finally showed up at the end. But then I enjoyed it the first time, but I was able to enjoy it more on subsequent viewings, because I wasn't constantly asking myself, so when is Mark Hamill showing up? Like,
yeah, I will at least give Blady, Jesus, I'm tired, man. Blade Runner 2049, the credit that Kay isn't actively searching for Deckard for a long time. He's searching for someone related to Deckard, right? I think, at least the way I took it, until it makes a hard turn and we're actively looking for him.
Yeah.
But there is definitely that impending feeling of just, when does Harrison Ford show up?
Yeah, exactly. So the film does center around the discovery of a child that was born by replicants, not built in a factory, which is eventually revealed to be the child of Deckard and Rachel, Sean Young's character from the original movie. And so for a long time, this movie, Gosling and the audience think that it's him. We think that Gosling is that child. But I think the story is a lot stronger for it when it is shown that he's not the child, when it is revealed that, you know, he's not the kid. He's just a replicant, and there isn't anything, like, quote-unquote special about him. But at that point, that reveal that Gosling is not the kid, at this point you've watched him for two straight hours, and you've seen him try to rail again, like, have that kind of sort of existential crisis of, like, what am I? Like, what does it mean to be a replicant, a human, or whatever? By the end of this movie, he accomplishes something. You know, he goes against his programming. He kind of proves that he has some kind of soul, and I think that ultimately adds to the movie that he's not the child that was, you know, the special child that was born by a replicant and not built in a factory, you know? He's just a replicant.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think that's an interesting way to fall, or interesting place to come down with this story, that, you know, where he's kind of, it for a long time is kind of the just, I don't know if there's a name, but, like, you know, like you said, the special child kind of trope, where, you know, the protagonist is the only one that could possibly have done this.
The chosen one trope.
The chosen one. Yeah, exactly.
That's a very easy trope to name.
I'm tired, like I said. You know, one of those kind of things. But then we take this turn where, nope, he's just a regular dude that happened to overcome some extraordinary circumstances and do some extraordinary things. But no, he's not the chosen one. He's just this other guy. Yeah. Basically.
Yeah, and the movie kind of leaves him just, like, kind of dying on the...
Yeah, he just bleeds out on the staircase. Yeah. And I definitely agree. You know, I'm a big fan of these kind of just meditation on humanity and creation and art kind of things. We've talked about that a lot in our Alien Covenant review, how it was so interesting that of Ridley Scott's franchises or you know, works to make that have that meditation, it was Alien Covenant, not Blade Runner,
right?
Because this Blade Runner 2049 is definitely about that also. There's a lot of you know, there's a really great line, I think, at one point where the character, I can't remember her name. It might be someone from the first movie, which I just didn't recognize. The older woman with one eye that, you know, after they kind of rescue Kay.
Okay. I don't think that was, that's a new character, I believe.
Okay. Yeah, it was possible. Yeah. I don't know.
I mean, the only original movie, Edward James almost appears briefly for a cameo. And outside of that, it's just Harrison Ford.
But she said, they say, you know, dying for a worthy cause is the most human thing we could do. We're talking about this kind of replicant uprising they're trying to start again. But I thought, I don't know, I thought that was a really powerful just moment, philosophy to take. Yeah. That is the most human thing you could do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do want to talk about actually the digital Sean Young cameo, which was amazing. I was floored when that moment happened. I thought it was just flat out unreal. Tell Rogue One to take its Tarkin out back and fucking shoot it.
That was definitely a slam. Oh, not a slam, but I felt like that was like a middle finger to Tarkin to me.
It was just a complete slap in the face. I mean, I was reading about how they managed to make that happen. And so I guess there was a stand-in actress who was digitally like superimposed over with Sean Young's likeness. And also they found like a sound-alike actress to kind of play Sean Young's voice. And also Sean Young actually, like, she wasn't really the performance, but she coached whoever was acting in like – being her in that scene.
Okay.
So there's a lot of elements that went into making that digital Sean Young cameo. And I think it's just, I mean, it was just so perfectly implemented. I think it's a perfect emotional beat for Deckard as he spots like the one physical difference that Neander Wallace didn't notice, the eyes. It's really just incredible. And I mean, like, I was mind blown by what I saw there. And I remember when we watched Rogue One, like I talked about Tarkin, I harped on Tarkin a lot because I fucking hated Tarkin in that movie. Like, I think it looks so like Uncanny Valley and like it looks like a PS4 game or something. And, you know, like, the technology is good, like, but also we don't need it, you know? And I feel like in this case, like it's less, it's, you know, it's one scene as opposed to throughout the entire movie.
Right.
But it just looks a lot better. Like it looks seamless. Like I thought it was actually Sean Young. And they use like the Marvel de-aging technology to make it happen.
That's what I thought also. I wondered if it was actually Sean Young just made to look younger.
Sean
Younger, yeah. But I also think that scene is just cinematography and everything and then the just filmmaking that is in that scene. Just with the lighting and the weird water ripple light thing effect that is in much of this movie in that building, in those scenes, and just the deep shadow is such a better moment to deploy that kind of technology. You know, to have this kind of CG character in, you know, or CG face, I guess, where you have this unique lighting and stuff that you could use to kind of show, you know, cover up a little bit, whereas Tarkin is just like a kind of main character and is just always in full-on light all the time and all this stuff. But yeah, I agree. That was definitely a standout moment, especially, like you said, when Deckard calls out what the difference is and, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty incredible. And like, that's like, this is a movie that it calls back to the original Blade Runner in kind of subtle ways, but that's the only real moment that's like, that's the only moment where it feels like a direct sequel to the original Blade Runner in certain respects, you know, because this feels like its own thing. But that's like, you know, a moment that's pretty much just focused on those two characters, Harrison Ford and Sean Young, and Jared Leto's character, Neander Wallace, in the background. But yeah, it's just, again, just a really incredible moment. And it just seemed like every few minutes we were getting moments like that. We were seeing something we hadn't seen before in this movie. You know, I think possibly my favorite moment of the movie, actually, is when Joy, the AI, hires Mackenzie Davis's sex worker and kind of like merges bodies with her so she can be with Kay. Like, just visually, that was just unbelievable to watch. You know, you have like these kind of like two women who are kind of drifting in and out of each other. It's pretty wild. Like, it was amazing, you know. And there's another scene when Kay finds Deckard and the two fight amidst this like short-circuiting hologram of Elvis. That's going on, and like the sound design is like off, and like it just looks like it's so off-putting and weird, and it's really just there's so much stuff that I feel like I will remember for a long time.
I'm interested to hear what you think about what was the character's name, was Love, I think, Wallace's like assistant or whatever. To me, she started out as very a really interesting, you know, kind of the oh man, I don't know how to phrase this thought exactly, but kind of, you know, we're talking about Kay and how he is able to overcome his programming at points and, you know, goes, you know, just is a replicant, but is able to have these human moments. Right. And Love seems like another character, another replicant able to have that, where, you know, she's crying during this fucking evil villain monologue that Leto has, which I guess, you know, happens, sure, when he is the birthday of the replicant that we get to watch, you know, with him,
right.
Where she's standing there crying and all these things. And it was really interesting. And then, you know, towards this third act where, you know, Harrison Ford shows up, she just kind of becomes a Terminator. And it was real weird to me.
Yeah.
It was still cool. Like, it's still badass and stuff, but it just felt like a weird turn for a character to take.
Okay. Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, I think there was a lot of interesting stuff going on with her character. I don't know if she ever became more than a Terminator for me, I guess.
Yeah.
Throughout
the movie. Guess that's true.
Because, I mean, there's, like, throughout the movie, she's doing, you know, Terminator-type things. She killed Jeff Malchin, like, immediately and all that.
Yeah, oh, yeah, that's true.
In a pretty badass scene. She kills Robin Wright and all that stuff. But I do think the movie kind of, and maybe it goes on for like 10 minutes too long. I don't know. The that final set piece where it's like the ship is sinking and they're like Deckard's about to drown and Ryan Gosling is fighting Love. I feel like that went on for like just a little too long. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And I wonder if that is a like weird reference or something to the final fight between Rucker Hauer and Harrison Ford that does take for fucking ever. And it's like in the rain and, you know, here we're on a beach, quote, you know, kind of thing.
Maybe. But I feel like I was more invested in that fight in the original movie, maybe because Rucker Hauer is such a like just powerhouse in that movie. Like, but I don't know. I feel like that's the only moment in the movie where I feel like it kind of sagged a little bit for me. And then it comes back in the end. It kind of comes back around. And that moment where Deckard reunites with his daughter and the movie ends is really solid. And I felt like it was a weird emotional beat to end on at first. But I don't know. The more I sit with it, the more like I kind of enjoyed it, I guess. But yeah, I mean, like Kay is investigating the daughter Stellene early on in the movie, who is eventually revealed to be Deckard's daughter. So she's only really in like one or two scenes in the movie. But you see her putting together these memories to implant onto replicants, and that's just like an incredible sequence too.
Yeah,
just, like her, like, you know, kind of moving around and like developing these memories while Kay looks on. That's just man, it's great. It's great. I feel like I'm just pointing to scenes now. Like, man, that was great. Man, that was great.
That's what a lot of this movie is, though.
So, Mike, is there any other spoilery things you wanted to discuss about Blade Runner 2049? What did you think of Jared Leto in this movie? He's only in, like, 5 minutes.
Yeah, and I guess I gave a bit of a preview to what I, you know, my gut reaction to it is he is giving a interesting performance, or I think a good performance for what his character is.
Yeah.
But I feel like his character isn't much more than super industrialist magnate that is God, wants to be God, and is given like a real hammy reading of a lot of delivery of a lot of his dialogue. But at the same time, it sort of does fit what his character is. So like I'm kind of two minds about it. I think it's okay. I think it's kind of cool and interesting on one level, but on another, you're just like being super villain, cutting open people because you can, kind of thing.
I mean, I'm with you. I think, I think he's. I actually like Jared Leto in this movie. I don't dislike him as an actor. I dislike a lot of the
typical.
Okay, I dislike some of his performances, and I dislike a lot of the movies that he's in. But I don't really dislike him as an actor. In general, I don't dislike anybody as an actor in general, because I think anybody can give off a good performance if they, you know, if the circumstances are right. But I think what helps that he doesn't overstay his welcome. Like, again, he's only in like 5 minutes of this movie, even though he was in like a lot of the marketing and stuff. He's in like maybe like a scene at the beginning and like a scene at the end.
Yeah, we kind of just check in with him every now and then for him to deliver some kind of I am God dialogue and we move on.
Yeah. It does almost feel like the movie is like sort of setting up like a third Blade Runner movie in its weird way. And
I think
that might have been the idea. Like, I think the studio did want this to launch some kind of franchise. And then once they saw what Denis Villeneuve delivered to them, they were like, well, that's not going to happen.
Yeah, you're right. It definitely is setting up this kind of like
like replicant uprising.
Yeah, this like, man, Hunger Games, like, this kind of like a, you know, peasant uprising going to take back the world kind of thing. Right. And it doesn't really go anywhere with it, kind of, thankfully, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I could see, you know, maybe 35 years from now when, you know, Blade Runner 2075 or whatever, we can get, you know, something like that. You know, we'll see what happens. But I think this is a perfect return to the Blade Runner universe, and it's a good place to leave it for now, I guess. Like, I don't want to risk I want to risk the goodwill I have with this Blade Runner universe now with another one just yet. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I agree. Yeah. I'm satisfied.
Yeah. I mean, this is like a ponderous, expensive, slowly paced, thoughtful, vast canvas that got a wide release in American theaters in 2017, which is kind of amazing by itself. The fact that the movie is as good as it is like kind of a bonus.
Yeah. It is definitely disappointing, though, that the studio kind of reacted or treated it the way they did post-release. Like, they've already pulled it from theaters, basically.
I mean, it's not – the movie has been underperforming. Like, it's not like it's –
You know. Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm thinking of what were they expecting, right?
Right. I mean, yeah, you know, this movie had a budget, I'm looking at it now, $150 to $185
million. Wow.
And it's made $223 million, so it made back its budget.
Yeah.
But, you know, it hasn't lit the box office on fire, and I don't think anybody could have reasonably expected it to.
right, so, exactly.
You know, but in its current form, I think Blade Runner 2049 is a pretty remarkable piece of work. We haven't even talked about the sound design, by the way, which Hans Zimmer's score, I believe. I think it's Hans Zimmer, right? He did the score for this? Yeah. It is incredible. I think he did great work here, too. Maybe not as good as the original movie score, which is by Vangelis, which is really memorable, but Hans Zimmer does a good job here. Wanted to throw that out there, too. But you have any final thoughts, Mike, before we wrap this up?
No, I think I've kind of expressed all of them to satisfaction for me.
Cool beans. I think we have expressed all of our thoughts to satisfaction.
I'm really tired, Mike.
I know, me too. Where can we find you online this week, Mike? And then you can go to bed.
All right. You can find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And if you like Dungeons & Dragons, my friends and I post our games at youtube.com/geonerd79.
And you can find me on twitter.com/msmithfilmblog and all of our podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com. Plus, you can find my work at crookedmarquee.com. Thanks for listening to Film Bookcast. Mike Smith, Mike DiCriccio. If you're listening to this review of our podcast on iTunes, please subscribe, rate, take a moment to give us a review. Feedback, compliments, topic discussions, hate mail can all be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you are emailing about in the title of your email, because we produce just so many different ones, hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Now, join us for the next episode of Film Bookcast, where we'll be talking my boy, Taika Waititi, and his new film, a little fantasy lark. You may have heard of it. It's called Thor Motherfucking Ragnarok.
I would love a director's cut where that's actually the name of the movie.
Knowing Taika Waititi, that might be on the way. And
yep.
And you can check out our next complete works, where we're talking Nicolas Cage's role in his first superhero film, 2007's Ghost Rider. Looking forward to that. So
yeah.
Thanks so much for listening, guys. We are out. Who wants to be my prince the other decade? I want to be alive. I am alive. Alive, I tell you. Mother, I love you.